My name is Stéphanie Clermont. Now we're going to be joined by Jesse Freeston. He's a video journalist and documentary maker. Since 2009, he's been covering the resistance movement of the people of Honduras, who have been under constant attack since June 2009 coup d'etat, which ousted President Manuel Zelaya. Jesse produced a series of short documentaries for the Real News Network about Honduras. His new movie is also about Honduras, and it's called Resistencia. Jesse, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
For those of us who haven't even heard of the 2009 coup d'etat, can you just give us a background, how it happened, and briefly what led to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the first time, really, in the history of Honduras, you had a president who actually came from the traditional political class. He, you know, was from essentially a landed oligarchy Spanish family, grew up with a large fortune that was made through logging, and was really a traditional politician for all intents and purposes. But as soon as he came to power and sort of got the view from above of what was going on and sort of the roots of poverty in his country, he did a kind of a crazy thing, and he actually changed his alliance completely. So during his four-year mandate, he started out by signing a free trade agreement, you know, in his first year in office with the United States and other places. So give you a sense of where he was, what line he was in at that point. Mm-hmm. And within the span of a couple of years, he goes from signing a free trade agreement to supporting a plan to rewrite the entire Honduran constitution, to open up the constitution, have it rewritten by every sector of the society, coming together and having a big constitutional referendum to replace the document, the original constitutional document that was written under U.S.-backed military dictatorship in 1981, that really has served to entrench the economic interests of 10 or 15 families in Honduras. And so it was actually, you know, this was something that was really poorly reported, surprised, by the media here in North America, which was what we were told about the coup was that Manuel Zelaya wanted to stay in power forever and that he was opening up the constitution in order to allow himself to be reelected. I mean, it's kind of crazy that that would be a reason for a coup in the first place, considering in this country you're allowed to be reelected as long as you want. In the United States, you're allowed 2 terms at least. In Honduras, you're only allowed 1 4-year term. Uh-huh. And but anyways, that wasn't the plan at all. Zelaya had actually picked up a long-standing proposal of a lot of indigenous communities in Honduras, which was to open up the constitution and rewrite it, to have them recognized within the constitution, to have, you know, various other kinds of rights, land rights, women's rights, rights to water, things enshrined in the constitution that as it stands now, are completely absent. And so he picked up this idea and went with it and went for a popular referendum, asking the people of Honduras whether or not they wanted to rewrite their constitution through this process of a constitutional assembly. And it was the first time in the history of Honduras that Hondurans would be asked a quest to vote or to have a voice on something other than just the name of the person that's going to rule them. And on that day, that was June 28th, 2009, that they were going to vote in this referendum on whether or not they wanted to rewrite the constitution. And that was the day that the coup happened. That was the morning that Manuel Zelaya, at 5 o'clock in the morning, was thrown on a military plane by the military and taken to Costa Rica and left in his pajamas in the airport. And the military took control of the streets that day. And over almost 3 years later now, they're still there. And actually, there's been a whole lot more investment into the military. And now there's actually more military on the streets today than there was the day of the coup.
Shortly after that, somebody called Porfirino Lobo, a.k.a. Pepe Lobo, became president of Honduras. It was portrayed here in, like you said, the little coverage that was of it as an election. Barack Obama met with him, praised him as a defender of democracy. Can you talk about Pepe Lobo and how he ended up in power?
Right. So the day of the coup, you know, marks the day that the military took control of the streets and stopped this popular project to rewrite the constitution. It also represents the day that the National People's Resistance Front was born. And since that moment, they've really been a grassroots force of which, you know, in my young life, I've never seen. They've got representation of everyone. They have a general assembly that meets regularly in every one of Honduras' 298 municipalities, from the tourist islands of Utila and Roatan, you know, to the valleys of Intibucá. You know, everyone has got representation with inside the resistance front, as well as all the different sectors that you can imagine that saw their interests reflected in this idea of rewriting the constitution, mm-hmm. whether it be the feminists, the indigenous indigenous communities, the black communities, Garifuna communities in Honduras. You know, men, women, there's youth, students, street vendors, taxi drivers, you name it. They're all represented inside the resistance movement. So the resistance following the coup was in the streets for every day for over 160 days.
From day one.
From day one. For 160 days, they were in the streets getting beaten. There was over 100 that were targeted assassinations of community organizers. People were tortured. Thousands of arbitrary detentions. And this was the time frame in which the Honduran coup regime, you know, decided they were going to go ahead with plans for presidential elections. It was a period in which the only presidential candidate that had opposed the coup, every time he tried to have a rally, he would be beaten brutally. He had his own arm broken. He was jailed a couple times, renounced his candidacy along with hundreds of other candidates for Congress and for mayors and things like this. And nonetheless, the United States, Canada, and a few other countries decided to support these elections. They went ahead under these situations. There's a whole lot of facts I could put about why these elections were a crazy idea. Maybe one thing that sort of illustrates a lot of the problems is that the military, 3 weeks before the elections took place, sent out a letter to every mayor in the country asking for addresses and contact information and phone numbers for everybody they knew in their municipality that was involved in the resistance movement. And then, according to Honduran law, the military is actually in charge of the elections. So they're the ones in charge of actually moving the ballot boxes from the voting centers to the tabulation centers and just in general running logistics during elections. So the same military that overthrew the elected president 5 months earlier was the one moving the ballot boxes around 5 months later. And this is how we got Porfirio Lobo. I shouldn't say we, as the people of Honduras primarily, got Porfirio Lobo as their president. And since then, a lot of the international community has declared the crisis over. We've returned to normality. A question of, you know, what's normal in Honduras? What's normal in Honduras is the world's highest recorded murder rate at a level of 83 people per 100,000 population in Honduras. That's 22 people a day in a country of 8 million people that are killed. This is normal in Honduras. This is what we call normal. The other thing is poverty rates over 80%. That's normal. Over 50% of the population doesn't have stable employment. Normal. So this is the normality that Honduras has returned to, and it's actually become much worse since the coup. And in terms of repression, it's been brutal. Honduras was recently declared by the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression as the most deadliest place to be a journalist. There's been 20, just 2 days ago, a journalist in the Aguan Valley, which we'll get to because that's what my film's about, was actually killed 17, he was attacked 17 times with a machete. And this is the 20th journalist to be killed since Porfirio Lobo took office just over 2 years ago, which makes it per capita the deadliest place in the world to be a journalist. And of these 20 journalists that have been killed, 18 of them had a critical line. You know, there's a clear evidence they had been very critical journalists, both of the coup, of the regime that's in place after the coup, and of the economic interests that supported the coup.
Recently in Montreal, there was a Honduran journalist that you know, that you've known from before. His name is Felix Molina. He was here to give a talk organized by the Comité pour la Justice Sociale, and he's now in Ottawa continuing his tour. Can you tell us about how you met him and who is this person, this journalist?
Well, Felix Molina, if there's any journalist that I've really tried to take on as a mentor, it's been Felix Molina. Felix hosts every night, Monday through Sunday, on prime time, 7 p.m., the resistance program of the Honduran Resistance. And it's broadcast across more than 30 stations. One privately owned network called Radio Globo that has about 17 stations all across the country and is really the only radio station with that kind of reach that was against the coup. And they were actually shut down numerous times by the military following the coup. It's also, you know, syndicated on community radio stations, not just all across Honduras, but even in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and neighboring countries as well, because Honduras has really become a focal point for people all across the region trying to figure out who's going to win this battle, because it has, you know, serious implications for everybody's future. And what Felix really represents is, for me, he's just really incredible at capturing all the different sides of the situation in Honduras. So on one level, you know, he's ferocious in his critique of the coup regime and you know, pointing out, bringing on people to describe the various things that are going on. He brings on economists and stuff like that. And he just does a really great job of bringing on experts and then doing really short, brief summaries of what they say so that everybody can capture what he's what's going on. And he's really respected as somebody that is a great go-between between, you know, experts and the people in Honduras. And but at the same time that he's doing that, he's also a real source of unity for the resistance movement, because it's brought together this incredible diversity, not just of, you know, people's identities and the kind of work that they do, but also because of their political visions. And Felix has really become a person that can reach out to every part of the resistance movement, bring them on his radio show, have everybody sit together and talk, and is a really, really good at maintaining that unity of this diverse resistance movement and being a source of hope too. You know, he travels the country visiting the Garifuna communities, visiting different communities, talking about their culture while at the same time talking about the repression that they're faced. So you're never left in this desperate position listening to Felix's program. So anyways, he's come to Canada. It's his first time to Canada, and it's been really interesting to be here. You know, a lot of people in Central America know about some of the things that go on in the United States. A lot of them have family in the United States. A lot of them have family who've been deported from the United States, who faced, you know, the things that come with working without documents in the United States. But they don't necessarily know about the realities in Canada. So for Felix to get here and find out that there's 140,000 students on strike.
Yeah, how did he react to that?
He was blown away, you know, and not just that Canada wasn't this utopia, you know, that I'd been trying to tell him was a myth to begin with. But I don't know if he actually believed me until he got here and saw these thousands of students on the streets and then see these riot police on horses.
Right.
You know, and hear these stories of, you know, raids by the police on meeting spaces for the students, and just hear about these tactics that he had thought were really things that were applied in his country and not here. And certainly there's graver risks in Honduras. But at the same time, you know, he's been reporting on his show. We've been co-hosting his show from here every night. And the first night we're on, I realized that he didn't, when he got on, he's talking to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Honduras, and he's saying that the students in Quebec are fighting for free education and the police are beating them up. And, you know, and I said, you know, Felix, I mean, they're not fighting for free education. Well, at least that's not the demand that's unifying everybody. It's just to keep education at, you know, roughly, you know, $3,000 a year. that's what they're fighting for. And he, you know, his mouth dropped. He couldn't believe it. He thought, you know, because in Honduras, the students are fighting for free education.
Right.
And, you know, obviously there's different, it's a different situation in terms of average income and what people can pay and stuff. But it, you know, he was blown away that there was this level of conflict when they're already paying $3,000 a year.
For journalists in Honduras, you mentioned it, it's extremely dangerous to keep about doing your work if you're not controlled by the state, by big corporate media. You talked about the huge courage of some of the journalists that you've met there in Honduras. You're a journalist, you're Canadian, you've been to Honduras. For somebody like you, is there a level of risk in going to Honduras as a foreigner and reporting on the political situation there and the social movement?
So I might be wrong in this, but my original answer is no. In the sense that if you think relatively about all the people that are in Honduras, probably the safest person in Honduras, or one of, is the foreign journalist. You know, one of the things that the regime does fear at some level is negative international coverage of the regime. And we know they fear this because they spend all kinds of money on lobbyists in the United States and Canada and Europe. Lobbyists that spend a lot of their time, actually, you know, we always think of lobbyists as lobbying government. They also spend a lot of their time lobbying media. Mm. So they hire these insiders. The main lobbyist for Honduras has been Lanny Davis, who's a very close friend of the Clinton family, was actually one of the key fundraisers for Hillary Clinton's 2008 election campaign. So he's really been able to rally the State Department, but he's also been able to get his own op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, and he's been on CNN talking about Honduras as if he was any expert in Honduras. I actually know for a fact he doesn't even speak Spanish, yet he's, you know, coming on as a hired gun. You know, the media knows that this man is hired. They know he's receiving thousands and thousands of dollars to speak on behalf of a coup regime, yet he's allowed to come across as an expert on Honduras. Anyways, all that to say that we know that the regime is very concerned with how it's viewed abroad, and how if news about its human rights abuses and the fact that there's a democratic resistance movement here, that's fighting against. If that gets out, that could affect maybe their funding, maybe their military aid, maybe their economic aid through some process that happens in North America or Europe. So in that situation, this is where you get to the really sad reality, unfortunately, with our media outlets, is that different lives have different values. And we can think about this in the question of how many poor farmers would the regime in Honduras have to kill to get on the front page of the New York Times? It's a really sick question to put out there. But if we think about it, you know, you have to go up into the thousands probably to make the front page of the New York Times. However, a foreign journalist, a Canadian journalist killed in Honduras would be front page.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, different lives have different values. And it actually took the killing in Honduras to take such a brutal form as the prison fire that many people have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
361 people killed in a prison fire, and this idea of being burned to death in a prison. And that's what it took to capture people's imagine, to capture the headlines about the killing that's going on in Honduras. I mean, these 361 are 361 out of thousands of people that are killed in Honduras every year. And but it was that visual thing that took to get onto the front page. So all this to say that I think that gives me, through the sickness of how this works, a kind of protection in the sense that they understand not just killing me, but taking my equipment or in any way getting in the way of my work could bring really negative international coverage. So while Honduran journalists are really fighting for their lives in Honduras, I definitely don't feel that. So it's really important. I would actually ask, places like the UN and Reporters Without Borders and things to be more clear when they make these reports about the dangers journalists face, that we're talking about, in this case, Honduran journalists. This is the dangers that Honduran journalists are facing.
And I imagine to encourage more foreign journalists to cover Honduras, because we barely ever hear anything about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also allows, for phenomenons like this, Kony 2012 video that a lot of people are seeing, where the outsider gets to put himself as the hero, put himself in front of the camera, going to Uganda to save the people, and all of the only reason why we accept these narratives, these ideas, is because we're not told the reality of what's going on the ground. And the fact that I'm not familiar with Uganda, I've never been to Africa, but I'm pretty sure there's lots of Ugandans working on the ground towards trying to stop any of the violations that are going on in Honduras. They could probably do a much better job of reaching a lasting solution than Americans coming in.
The angle that your new film Resistencia takes is one of Honduran people leading a huge struggle for themselves, principally about the farmers of the Alguan Valley, is that right?
Yeah, the Alguan Valley. So following the resistance, the rise of the resistance movement, very early on, actually after the elections that we previously talked about, elections within quotation marks, the farmers of the Alguan Valley, 3,000 farming families, decided to occupy the palm plantations of the richest man in Honduras, a key supporter of the coup, Miguel Facuse. And so since then, or they're going on over 2 years of occupying some of the most fertile land in all of Central America, occupying over 5,000 hectares of African palm plantations. And they're producing the land and defending it. And they're going up against essentially armed paramilitary groups, the police, the military. Over 50 farmers have been killed in the valley for this, 50 farmers involved with this movement. And so my documentary, I had the great privilege of being able to stay in the occupation for months filming, and so my documentary looks at that, and it was really terrifying to come back after being in this and especially seeing the Occupy movement take hold in North America and seeing how that inspired people and saying, well, if we are interested in the stories of Tahrir Square and interested in the stories of Occupy Wall Street, we really should be interested in the story of the Aguan Valley. Because not to do comparisons and to say one's more incredible than the other, but if we're interested about the occupying of public squares,
yep,
we should be interested about the occupying of plantations, which mm-hmm. are really affecting the bottom line, the profit margin of the people that are supporting the 1%. So this is the 0.0001% of Honduras. They've occupied his plantations and maintained it for 2.5 years. So I come back with this and I'm talking to the CBC and I go to documentary festivals and I'm trying to get traditional funding for this thing. And everybody's telling me, various reasons for why it's not an interesting story, including one person at the CBC who told me that it's an incredible story and this is incredible that you have all this footage. If only it was in Iran, I would fund it today. But unfortunately, people don't care about Honduras. And I, you know, I found that quite frightening. And what's been really exciting is, so we launched a crowdfunding campaign through the Indiegogo website.
Yeah.
And the response has been amazing. In just 2 weeks, there's been over 200 people that have donated at an average donation of about $65. We've been able to raise over $13,000 now in 2 weeks, trying to get to $20,000. I myself, I have a rough cut, almost finished, of the movie. But in order for this thing to be really good and to really do justice to the story, I have to realize that my video editing skills, my skills are not enough, you know, to get this done. So we're trying to bring in, use that money to contract people to bring in sound designer, animator, fine editor, things like this, and a web designer.
And so can you give the website so people can go and support if they support your movie?
Absolutely. So it's www.resistenciathefilm.com. So that's R-E-S-I-S-T-E-N-C-I-A, the film, all one word, .com.
Jesse Friesen, thank you so much for being with us on the show today. Jesse Friesen, filmmaker who has been covering the Honduran resistance movement since 2009. His new movie is about the Aguan Valley farmers of Honduras. It's called Resistencia. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Stephanie and Jesse. So right now in Montreal, you're looking at 1 degree Celsius with a lot of fog. It's going to get up to 5 degrees this afternoon. It's going to be cloudy with a little bit of rain. And for the rest of the week, we've got 10 degrees tomorrow, 11 degrees Friday with more rain. And this weekend, it's actually going to get up to 16, 17 degrees. It's going to be really warm. And I want you all to stay tuned because you're listening to the Wednesday edition of The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host, Courtney Kirkby. Behind the boards, we have Vanessa Sparks. We're heading into the 8 a.m. hour. And in the next hour, we'll bring you our bike traffic reporter, Jesse, with the latest from the bike paths of Montreal, which have finally lost all their snow, plus moving picture radio. We'll check out some music from a few bands and also some interview that was recorded at a recent immigration conference in Toronto. But first, we're going to go to New York for the headlines from Democracy Now!